versus City of Papillion, Justice Miller Lerman is recused from this matter. Mr. Bruno, good morning to you.
May it please the court. My name is Jason Bruno, here on behalf of Pinnacle Enterprises, Inc. Pinnacle's owner, Brian Katz, is in the audience today. We are here today asking this court to reinstate a condemnation case that was initiated by the City of Papillion back in June of 2013. That case was sua sponte dismissed later in 2018 by a recently appointed new trial judge on the case for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. We believe that dismissal was clearly erroneous because it was premised upon an erroneous determination that a petition on appeal in a condemnation case is jurisdictional. Under the case law and the statutes, it's clearly not. Under the plain language of Nebraska Revised Statute Section 76-717, in this court's precedent, the only thing that vests jurisdiction in a district court in a condemnation case is the notice of appeal filed in the county court. It is undisputed in this case that the notice of appeal was timely filed. There is no issue on that regard. This was not a case where there was any jurisdictional defect. There was no subject matter jurisdiction issue. The inquiry should end there and the case should be reinstated.
Mr. Bruno.
Yes.
Let me ask it in this way. Under the statute as it now exists, the first party to file the appeal does not file a petition on appeal, and the trial court orders that party to do so, and that party then fails to do so. Is it your argument that the district court lacks the power to dismiss the petition or to dismiss the appeal based upon the failure to obey the court's order?
I think that what happens, it's not a jurisdictional issue at that point. In that circumstance, the district court is expressly vested with discretion to award a reasonable sanction. Whether that sanction at one point in time could rise to the level of dismissal, I think is a question of another day, but that's not the circumstance that happened in this case.
And would you care to explain to us how the situation here was different than the hypothetical that I just explained?
It was different because if you look at the plain language of the statute, the statute reads that if no petition on appeal is filed, the district court shall order the first party filing the notice of appeal to file the petition on appeal.
Did the district court ever enter such an order?
No, and that is why the district court had no authority or no discretion to award any sanction, because the condition set forth in the statute was never met in this case, because my client acted diligently and filed the petition on appeal, albeit a little late. So that's one of the issues. Now,
Would the district court need jurisdiction to enter a sanction?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the district court clearly had subject matter jurisdiction over this case. I mean, there's no question in my mind, based on the plain language of the statute and this court's decision, that as soon as that notice of appeal was timely filed in the county court, the district court had jurisdiction over the appeal.
Now, your opponent argues or asserts a number of cases that suggest to the contrary. What is your response?
I like my opponent very well, very, very much, but he is wrong. And let me tell you why. Because all of those cases predate the amendment to Nebraska Revised Statute Section 76-717. My opponent has not cited a case and will not cite a case today that applies the good cause standard since 1983, because the good cause standard is no longer necessary. How the statute used to read, it used to read that if no petition on appeal is filed, the court shall dismiss the appeal unless good cause is shown for the failure to file. It got amended probably back in 1983 and then again in 1994. And since that time, as this court noticed in the Singleton case, that any cases decided after 1983 shall not rely upon the Singleton case, but instead shall rely upon the plain language of the statute, because the legislator fixed the ambiguity that previously existed in the statute, and that's where the district court further erred, because the district court applied a good cause standard. Well, that's not the correct standard anymore. That was abolished and superseded by the 1983 amendment to the statute. If you look at the statute as it's now written, good cause is no longer in there. And as I mentioned before, this court set forth that in cases after 1993, you have to look to the statute, which says the court shall direct the first party to perfect an appeal, to file a petition, and impose such sanctions as are reasonable. As I said before, the condition was never met because Pinnacle filed its petition on appeal before it was ordered to do so. No harm, no foul, as Judge Zastera effectively found when this issue was raised before him in 2013. But even if we want to go back and utilize the good cause standard, the district court abused its discretion in imposing effectively a sanction of a dismissal. There's no dispute in the record that other than this two-week delay in the petition on appeal, you know, Pinnacle was a good litigant. It complied with all the orders of the court, it complied with all the discovery, it diligently prosecuted its case for over 5 years, spent probably over $100,000 in attorney's fees and costs. There were 8 experts, 14 depositions. To dismiss a case 5 years after the fact for a 14-day delay in a petition on appeal that caused no prejudice is an abuse of discretion and is not reasonable, and it shouldn't have happened. Especially considering, in this case, the circumstances as set forth in the evidence show that the two-week delay was justified. My client unfortunately hired a lawyer who filed the notice of appeal to vest the court with jurisdiction, and then retired from the practice of law. Hopefully not because of this case. So he never filed a petition on appeal, but my client did act diligently. He met with me, and literally within 24 hours of the meeting, I filed the petition on appeal on his behalf without getting paid and without getting a retainer. Probably not the smartest thing I ever did, but I was trying to protect his rights and trying to avoid what actually happened to him. So he took corrective action. But more importantly, there's no prejudice in the record. No prejudice was ever asserted by Papillion. There was no evidence of any prejudice because there wasn't any. It was a two-week delay. So what? The judge Zastera gave him additional time to answer. Nobody was harmed. And my final argument on the jurisdictional issue is it shouldn't have been raised sua sponte by Judge Thompson, you know, 5 years into the case. The matter was presented to Judge Zastera. It was briefed to Judge Zastera. Evidence was submitted. Arguments were made. Judge Zastera issued a ruling. There was no point to go back and look at it later on.
So well, if it's jurisdictional, it could be raised at any time, right?
Absolutely.
But your position is it's not jurisdictional, and so for that reason it was inappropriate for it to be revisited 5 years later?
If it was jurisdictional, yes, it could be revisited at any time, but this case clearly was not jurisdictional under the plain language of the statute and the case law. This wasn't a jurisdictional issue, still is not a jurisdictional issue.
You have argued in brief, I believe, that the law of the case doctrine applies.
Correct.
Doesn't the law of the case doctrine require an intervening appeal or opportunity for appeal?
I think so, but it's not just the law of the case. It goes a step beyond that because the courts are supposed to have consistency and finality of their orders so parties like my clients could rely upon those. So a judge should only reconsider his or her previous rulings or those of another judge, except in extraordinary circumstances, was not the case here.
What about if one judge recuses him or herself? Can the successor judge revisit?
I certainly think a successor judge can and should revisit certain issues, but in this case there was no reason or basis for it because
even if Judge Zastera had concluded that he had erred in his original ruling, there would have been nothing to prevent him from revisiting that ruling, would there?
I would agree with that, yes.
In other words, it was purely an interlocutory.
No question about it.
And consequently, Judge Thompson had just as much authority to revisit that ruling as Judge Zastera would have had.
Correct, but I think Judge Thompson reviewed it under an incorrect present.
That's the heart of your argument.
That's the heart of my argument. Judge Thompson's discretion was not in whether he had jurisdiction, if any, was what sanction to impose for the two-week delay in filing, assuming the preconditions of the statute were met. The second issue I have is regarding the motion for sanctions. We were granted we filed a motion in limine to preclude any evidence of Papillion from diminishing the taking. That motion in limine was granted. It was immediately, a motion for reconsideration was immediately filed. That was denied. So what happens? Judge Thompson gets put on the case, and not too long after, Papillion files a motion for summary judgment, saying they're entitled to judgment as a matter of law.
Once again, aren't we dealing with interlocutory orders?
Yes, correct. But what they didn't do is tell Judge Thompson about the previous orders. They didn't ask for reconsideration. They went in there and said, well, we're entitled to judgment as a matter of law, even though these issues were already decided the exact opposite way. But more importantly, they said, we're entitled to judgment as a matter of law based on evidence that Judge Zastera said couldn't be even admitted for any purpose because it was irrelevant. They did it twice. That's sanctionable conduct. My client shouldn't have to pay for that. So I'm out of time. If the court has any additional questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Fisher, good morning to you.
Good morning, sir. And good morning to the court.
May it please the court.
Counsel,
my name is Dan Fisher with the Coley Jessen Law Firm, and I'm privileged to stand before you on behalf of the city of Papillion this morning. We believe that Judge Thompson's ruling should be affirmed both on the sanctions order and on the jurisdictional issue, or at least on the dismissal, whether or not it is considered a jurisdictional issue.
So what's your best argument that it was jurisdictional?
The best argument that it's jurisdictional, I would first start with conceding that the statute says that jurisdiction is conferred upon the filing of a notice of appeal, and the notice of appeal was filed timely.
And don't all those cases that are cited so artfully in your brief predate the statutory amendment?
Those cases that talk about the petition being jurisdictional are all predating the statute. That's correct.
So on that point, aren't all of those cases superseded by statute insofar as the jurisdictional claim is concerned?
Well, you're asking me what my best argument is for the jurisdictional statement, and I think what those cases may at least give guidance for, if the court would decide to go this way, is that it is possible for subject matter jurisdiction to fall away. That is possible. We see it, like, for example, subject matter jurisdiction in federal court on diversity grounds. You confer the jurisdiction the moment you allege that there's the $80,000 minimum amount in controversy and that there's complete diversity between the parties. But if facts come on later that you realize that any of that's in error, then the jurisdiction that was properly conferred before falls away. So the best argument I have that it was jurisdictional would be those cases would still give us the indication that if you treat the rest of the statute as additional requirements that they have to meet in order to maintain the case before the district court, and they fail in those requirements, you may have a failing of the of subject matter jurisdiction. It's one way to look at the dismissal. I'd say that's probably excuse me. I would say that's probably our best argument that it is a jurisdictional issue, because of course we have to concede that the statute says the notice is enough to confer the jurisdiction. The question then is in the what the rest of the statute requires, is that required to maintain the jurisdiction of the court?
Okay.
If it does, then obviously it falls away if we don't meet. If it doesn't, then we've ended the jurisdictional inquiry once the notice is filed.
Did the district court ever enter an order directing Pinnacle to file a petition on appeal?
It did not. The district
court. So how could there ever be a sanction for failing to do something that the party was never ordered to do?
Well, I think the reason why is because that part of the requirement to order them to file the petition was obviated by the fact that Pinnacle affirmatively filed the petition, now without leave to do so out of time, but did file a petition. So there might be some mootness to the requirement that they be ordered to file the petition. I don't think the sanction of dismissal is limited, though, in a circumstance where the court would say, file your petition because you haven't yet, and then a party refuses or fails to do so.
What's the statutory goal or purpose of requiring the petition on appeal and using a scheme whereby if one is not filed within the 50 days, the district court orders the party to do it? What's the legislative intent behind that?
Well, obviously the first place we look for the legislative intent is the language of the statute itself.
Isn't it to move the case along? Isn't this clearly a case progression goal? Move it along. Isn't that what the legislature was saying not, this isn't jurisdictional. They said that expressly. It's not jurisdictional. Move it along. Isn't that what this is all about?
Well, certainly the language could be interpreted to mean that, because the legislature is telling the court to direct the party to file the petition. So that would be one interpretation. But that wasn't the only thing the legislature said. The legislature also said, you shall impose such sanctions are as reasonable. And I think one of the things you heard from Pinnacle this morning was, while the good cause standard is out, well, there is a standard in the statute, and it's that reasonableness for that sanction.
Is that what Judge Zastera did in his initial order, though?
No. We don't know what Judge Zastera did.
Well, we know what he did. He didn't order any sanctions. He let the case go forward. We know that.
True. All we know is that Judge Zastera said motion denied. We know nothing more than that.
So no sanction, no dismissal, case moves forward.
We don't know whether he considered the sanctions and rejected them, or if he just didn't consider the sanctions at all. We don't know. When the court just gives an order that says motion denied, we have to speculate as to how the judge got to that reasoning, which was part of what Judge Thompson's concern was in many of the orders that he was then dealing with, the prior orders that he was dealing with in this case, was he didn't have the benefit of any reasoning or analysis. He didn't
have. Does the statute require specific finding or articulation of reasoning? Does the statute set forth that requirement?
It certainly does require the court to make certain decisions, and we just don't know whether Judge Zastera went through that analysis or not. So I think the statute does on its plain language, and that was Judge Thompson's difficulty was, well, what happened or didn't happen?
Did you request any clarification from Judge Zastera or refile your motion?
Not as part of the record, no. Now, whether or not that happened off the record, I don't know. But as part of the record, no. I'm not aware of any of that. And in fact, I believe by the time this came up, Judge Zastera might have actually been retired from the bench. But there was a short period of time after the case was transferred to Judge Thompson where Judge Zastera had recused himself based on conflict with the witness. There was a short window of time between that point and when Judge Zastera left the district court bench on retirement. I don't remember whether this occurred during that time. It may have occurred while he was still on the bench, but there's nothing in the record that indicates Judge Thompson went back to talk to him about it.
Even if we assume that some sanction was appropriate here, what's your argument for why this, I mean, this seems like kind of a nuclear bomb sanction of dismissal, the case is gone, for being 2 weeks late. What's the best argument for why that's reasonable?
Sure. Because the statute requires some objective test, the reasonableness test. What's the best availability in our case law for a judge to apply reasonableness to this standard? And I think it's the good cause standard. I think the good cause standard still is the best test for reasonableness.
Well, good cause was taken out of the statute, correct?
Yeah, the very, very early version of the statute did have a good cause version, a good cause language in there. That was taken out, and the statute was amended again, and it has this language that we're talking about now, about the notice being the appeal. And then we added the language about the reasonableness. Well, the reasonableness is some objective test. So the question is, was the judge reasonable in using a good cause standard to analyze whether or not there should be a late filing or not? Because I would submit to you that from the nuclear bomb standpoint, there's two things I would say. First of which is, we need to step back from the fact that it was revisited later, because the analysis is supposed to be at the time of the motion, because the city never waived this. The city brought this issue up and said, we think this should be dismissed because they failed to file within the time period. So,
but by the time that motion was heard, the petition was on file, correct?
That is correct. Yes,
and so
ma'am.
Shouldn't we assume that that's why the district court judge overruled the motion to dismiss and didn't impose sanctions? Doesn't that make the most sense?
Well, there's no way to know. That's part of the problem that Judge Thompson struggled with, is he's having to speculate and guess as to what the reasoning is. We don't know. He didn't say it from the bench on the record, and he didn't put it in the order. So we don't know, and that's what Judge Thompson faced when he said, you know, I see the statute tells us to do this. I don't see any orders that actually do it, and I think I have to. I've been advised by the appellate judges that I need to revisit and always ask myself, do I have jurisdiction to proceed? Now, whether it's a jurisdictional analysis or not, I think he still got to the right result, because what we have here is a situation where Pinnacle did miss the deadline by 2 weeks. And Pinnacle had no good cause for doing so.
Even if good cause is part of the reasonableness standard, could prejudice or lack thereof to your client also be part of the reasonableness test? And if so, can you point us to any prejudice that your client suffered as a result of Pinnacle being allowed to file this 2 weeks late?
I don't think the burden shifts for the city to prove there was no prejudice, as Pinnacle, I believe, has argued in this case. But I would acknowledge that prejudice would be a factor that the trial judge might consider in determining what sanction was reasonable or not. With respect to the prejudice that the city does face in this case, certainly the certainty of the case moving forward and the interest that's being borne on and accruing on the amount that's deposited with the clerk that was the award of appraisers. If you remember, when you get the results of the appraisers, if the city wants to continue to take the land while the appeal goes forward, it has to submit the amount the award of appraisers down below gave, so that's sitting there, so that's accruing interest. So you have that prejudice. Any specific prejudice in this case, I can't honestly tell you that there's anything specific that the city was harmed. I see that I'm out of time. May I be allowed to finish answering that question and collude? Thank you. So I don't think there's anything specific in the case that I can point you to other than that need for all litigants to have some certainty to the matter, some necessary case progression of knowing that's going to go on. I think there's times, going back to your question about the nuclear option, I think there are times where somebody could miss a deadline by one day, not have good cause, and I think that's justified to dismiss their case for not having good cause by the very definition. Though I think there's times a party could have a 3-week miss of a deadline, but they might have good cause, and that might be acceptable. That's why good cause is on a case-by-case basis, reviewed on an abuse of discretion standard, because it gives the trial judge the ability to consider those factors and determine whether or not, in this case, there was good cause. Because as we know from this court's rulings, good cause needs to be something more than just inattention or an excuse. It needs to be something that truly the litigant had no fault for, that there was something other than just inattention. I think that we cited the Iowa Supreme Court where it said, it defined it as there has to be something more than just something outside the power of the litigant to prevent. And and Pinnacle simply didn't present that kind of evidence, and it was its duty to do so, even if the court would still consider whether or not there was any prejudice to the city on that issue. Hoping that that answered the question posed to the court, since I'm out of time, I have just a moment to conclude then.
It better be a moment.
Yes, sir. Thank you. So, briefly, with respect to what we're asking, we've already talked about why we're asking the court to be affirmed as to the dismissal, whether it's jurisdictional or not, it got to the right result. With respect to the sanctions, the only thing that we would add and conclude there is that motions in limine are not final orders of anything. Evidence still has to be presented at trial. In this case, we hadn't gotten to a trial yet. We'd used it in a summary judgment proceeding. Motions in limine don't govern summary judgment proceedings, and we were presenting evidence on what we believe we had black letter Nebraska law to support us on, and we would ask that the judge's decision on denying the motion for sanctions for us just bringing a partial summary judgment before him also be affirmed. And we thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. That concludes arguments for the day. Court is adjourned and you are excused.